6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The consolidation of the Custer cases, pretrial motions.
I'm very embarrassed on tape. Let me see where I should start. When we filed the pretrial motions on November 15th, 1973, which was the first set of pretrial motions, they were called the consolidated pretrial motions. And what we did was the first motion was called a motion to consolidate for the purposes of pretrial motions. It was just supposed to be a sort of a bookkeeping type of a deal, but it would make it a lot easier if we could have one hearing on all of the motions for all of the defendants instead of having what might be 19 different hearings on pretrial motions. Janko had no objections to it and filed something saying he had no objections to it. And the judge established, Judge Bottom that is, established a master file of Custer cases, which he never actually wrote us an order saying that the cases were consolidated, but that seemed to be the implication of this order he did write. This is the motion to consolidate. And you see, he order establishing a master file. Okay. And it says, for the purposes of filing pretrial motions, motions or what is known as opinions filed therein shall be considered filed in each of the above cases. So it seemed to be what we wanted. Janko's reply says he doesn't have any objections. So after, what date was this? The 4th of December, the judge filed the order. After that date, we took it on assumption that the cases were consolidated for the purposes of pretrial motions. Now, at that point, it was unclear if David Hill's case was consolidated. Remember I said the other day about David's case being taken sort of separately because Keller was his lawyer in the beginning. And David's pretrial motions were filed separately from everybody else's. So it was unclear if he would be considered in the consolidation or not. At this point, I don't think anyone remembers that except us. And so everybody would assume that he was with everybody else. I had sort of forgotten about it until I was looking through his file at one point. But his motions were originally filed separately at a later date from ours. For the most part, they were copied from ours. So they have very little substantive difference. Then David's was the first case that was moved to trial. So we were supposed to have the hearing on his particular pretrial motion, so the issue of the consolidation never really came up at that point. When it did come up was later on, when they tried to move us to trial on, they tried to move a pretrial hearing on February 28th of 74. That was that hearing where Ramon showed up in a big fiasco of the hearing. It was then that the issue came up, because we were saying, you know, how can you have pretrial hearings? How can Judge Fauchon, before whom the motions weren't even filed, have hearings on motions before defendants when Judge Bottom gave us an order which consolidates all of them, you know? And the assumption seemed to be that Judge Bottom, having given us the order establishing the master file for the Custer cases, intended to have the hearing on the consolidated pretrial motions.
So at that point, our position was that the pretrial motions were consolidated and we would fight for that.
Yeah, that was clearly our position all along, really. It's a position that everyone else has changed on their positions about it, except for us. And we've been very consistent all along, up until the very recent past, in saying that the cases are consolidated for pretrial motions. So, you know, we argued it then, and Judge Fauchon said, oh, yeah, they're consolidated. These four defendants are consolidated. I'm not having separate hearings on these four defendants, you know, on each of these four defendants. He was just clearly off the wall and didn't know what he was talking about, didn't know what we meant. So he, you know, proceeded with his hearings on those defendants, and of course Bottom in the meantime is proceeding on a continuance for the other Custer defendants and set a pretrial hearing for April 15th for, you know, what ended up being the Bad Heart Bull 5. Which later ended up being Bad Heart Bull 3. Gil, Dean, Bad Heart Bull, High Angle, and Dahl. And so, you know, when it came up with Bottom later on in April, he did the same thing. He said, yeah, well, they're consolidated. We said the cases are consolidated for the purposes of pretrial motions. You know, here's your order. And Janko didn't object. And he said, well, these five are consolidated.
Okay, well, when the Master Files established, we filed motions and had hearings on them, we got decisions on them?
No, see, we never did. That's it. We never set a hearing for the motions because we were in no... We never were anxious to go to trial on them. We were always in a position trying to push them, you know, back. And that's, I think, what happened. See, like, we were in the position of wanting them consolidated for hearing so that we could have one simple hearing for everybody. There would be a long hearing, okay? Janko was in the position of trying to get any case to trial. He had his preferences for any case. He didn't give a shit what happened with the pretrial motions. So he was, well, we were constantly in this position of Janko pushing a case to trial, you know, like what I said earlier, us trying to stop that particular case from going to trial. And one of the arguments we always raised was consolidation. And they continuously ignored it. I mean, there were various responses, but usually the responses were to the effect of, well, the defendants that are before me are consolidated, but, you know, I can't decide, like what Bonham said in April was, I can't decide for, you know, all these defendants who aren't here. He said, I can't make, you know, dispose of motions for defendants who aren't here, so we'll only have to make this relevant to the ones who are in front of me. Always ignoring, you know, the essential thing. So that's how it continued all along. We pretty much didn't struggle with it that much more after Bad Her Boy. It was obvious that everybody was going to ignore it. So
for the purposes of that, for the purposes of it being consolidated, there's never been a decision. You can't consider Fleischmann's decision.
Bottom's decision.
Well, Fleischmann did it first, didn't he?
Well, see, I think in Bottom's order establishing the master file.
We can't consider Fleischmann's original decisions on the hearings to be the decision for everybody. So none of them, there's never
no decision has ever been for everybody.
Okay.
That's essentially what it comes down to. But that's what's odd about it, because come February 1975, we go to the pretrial conference for Dennis's case, and Dennis says, well, what about my pretrial motions? I've never had a hearing. You know, I have all of these motions that need to be filed. The judge says, you've already filed your motions a long time ago. You filed motions in November, and then you filed later motions. Because what we did was, besides the November motions, in March more motions were filed, additions, you know, there was additions to some, and there were new motions filed, and then again in April, which is normal.
Did Fleischmann and Bottom say very clearly that? Fleischmann and Bottom made it very clear in the record.
That they were deciding only for those defendants. Yeah. That became a very big part of the writ of prohibition in Dennis's case, the one that eventually won us the continuance until June, when we went to the state Supreme Court. We researched all that, and where all that information is in the transcripts, okay, up there. Because what we do is when we were preparing the writ of prohibition, we read through the transcripts again, and very clearly in a number of different places, both Beauchamp and Bottom say, I'm only deciding for the defendants before me. But Janko pulled this trip this past February of saying to Dennis, but you filed consolidated pretrial motions. Your motions have been decided already. And we, you know, it was just stupendous that he would try to pull that. I mean, just astounding that he would try to pull that. Because all along, he'd been arguing the opposite. All along, he'd just been saying, you know, more or less what his opinion seemed to be was, I don't care what these people want to do for a day or two before trial, as long as we can move to trial, and always ignored the consolidation. And all of a sudden, here he is, so anxious to move Dennis to trial that he didn't even want to have pretrial hearings. It's just amazing. So, by this point, starting with Dennis's case, made a conscious decision to drop it. It's important because it's important for history, the history of the cases. But we won't argue anymore about them being consolidated. The only thing that is, the thing that's really relevant is that all of those original motions that are in that box, the consolidated pretrial motions box, okay, they're all the yellow labeled file. They were all filed for every defendant, even for Jim Robidoux, even though he wasn't a named defendant at the time, because the order establishing the master file establishes is a file. If you notice the way it reads, it says State of South Dakota versus 22 defendants, which includes, see, the three John Does. State of South Dakota plaintiff versus 22 defendants resulting from the February 6th incident. So you see, those motions were even filed for Jim. Never decided for anyone, other than the, you know, the people who have gone to trial.
I guess we're not in the position of changing our stance because Jankler changed his stance. And ours was reactionary to that.
You mean ours now that, saying that yeah. we don't care about consolidation?
No, in that we've argued all along that they are consolidated, and now it seems to me TJP's arguing that they're not consolidated.
Well, we're not going to argue anything anymore. I think that the decision isn't so much that we're going to argue now that they're not consolidated, so much as that we've made our record in the past, and for whatever purpose it's necessary to show that at one time, you know, we made the motion, the judge established the order, and Jankler had no objections, because that's important, because it shows Jankler jacking us around, and the court's jacking us around. For that, you know, for that reason, we should, you know, we can argue that in the past they were consolidated, and for the purposes of them having been filed in everybody's case, we would have, you know, we would stand, we're consistent, because our position has been that they ought to be consolidated, and yet the reality is that they never have been decided for all defendants. And it would be, it would not mean being consistent to say, for instance, that Beauchamp's decisions were for everybody, because that would raise a whole other issue, which is decisions being made for a defendant who's not in court. And so it's always very clear that over our objections, you know, these pretrial motions were going ahead, but it was clearly not going ahead for any defendant who wasn't in court. So we've maintained consistency.
Have they been decided, like David Hill, would his pretrial motions have been considered to be decided out of the case that he went to trial with?
Well, David and Lou are in a unique position, and that's a real good question. David, because in December, the first time when they tried to move him to trial, nothing was decided, no motions were decided. But in April, motions were decided, and he was there throughout all of the hearings. The same with Lou Bean. So the motions that were filed prior to that time, my understanding would be that they would be considered decided for David and Lou. But given what our stance is at this point, which is that since they jacked us around so much, and since, you know, since there are always new motions that would come up, we would still have the right to file more motions in their cases. Like in the wounded knee cases, which is where we originally get the idea to do this, in the wounded knee cases, they had consolidated pretrial motions, which were filed and decided way, way long time ago. But then as every trial comes up, they have whole, you know, new sets of pretrial motions specific to a specific defendant. So we could do the same thing with David and Lou.
You can present the same motion. Like,
worded
when we present more motions, we don't have to, they don't have to be different motions that have already been decided. We can just present anything we want.
Right. That's one of the reasons why we've dropped the argument at this point about the consolidation, because we don't want to stand on the old motions. The old motions aren't good enough. I mean, all of the Tubi motions and everything, it's been developed since then. We've been improving steadily as we go along. Like, okay, one good area to take would be discovery. Now, there was an original discovery motion filed, which was so-so. There were three additions to that through last spring. And then the one we just filed this spring is, you know, the penultimate of our discovery motions. It's a 50-point discovery motion. You know, much, much better. I mean, as we've gone along, of course, we've learned a lot more about what we want. It comes from two things. One, from having a better idea of the cases and being better prepared. And two, and getting better experienced lawyers preparing the motions and that sort of thing. So that we wouldn't want to stand on consolidated motions, and that's the decision that we made in January, February. People really made that before I came back, decided that we would stop arguing about it at this point because we want to file new motions in every case. And what will happen is, that brings up a whole new thing, I guess I should go into. Since consolidation, okay, since the consolidated pretrial motion, through last spring, we were still in the position that things were consolidated. So what we did when we filed new motions, like those new discovery motions I mentioned, we would file them in the specific case at hand, say Carlson et al., the four defendants in Peer, and file it in Russell Means et al., which was the name of the master file, which would mean that it would be filed for everybody. And that's what we did all last spring. Any of the motions that we filed in March, any of the motions that we filed in April, they were all considered to be consolidated motions as well, even though they weren't part of the original November 15th motions. And they're all still in that consolidated box. Like, if you look through, the best example is Discovery. Okay, you got the motion for discovery, and you've got sections A, 8A, 8B, 8C, and plain old 8. And let me just go through here. Okay, so you get the consolidated motion for discovery is the first one. And then we've got Janklow's reply. Then we've got the first, that's the brief. Somewhere around here should be the first amendment to it, then the second amendment to it, third amendment to it, like that. And so all of those things that were filed, say, through 1973 and 1974, are all in consolidated ones. They're all still considered part of the consolidated. The motions that are not considered part of the consolidated are the most recent ones that we've developed and the most recent ones filed. So you've got all of the motions that were done by the people in California. We call the 2B motions up here. Okay? And 2B motions are in the back. And we use them as a resource for all pretrial motions for all cases. The 2B motions are not a set of motions that's been filed, but only a set of motions that's been developed.
Yeah, where are most of the 2B motions in California? A lot of 2B filed things are empty.
That's because they haven't been done, because we decided not to use them for Dennis's case. Then this is the Dennis Banks pretrial motions. Now this should be, these should be very much the same with some exceptions. There's some things that are still unclear in my mind about all of these motions, but what this file, the Dennis Banks file is the motions we've actually filed in Dennis Banks' case. Or that we're going to file. I think they've all been filed, but I'm really not positive of that. Definitely all the ones we've decided to file. Okay, you've got in the front of here somewhere, you've got two different files. Okay, here. No, that's not it. There should be two files, one of which says the motions that we filed on February 28th. It's the, I don't see it. Master copy of pretrial motions filed February 28th. Okay, there it is. And master copy of pretrial motions filed 4175. They both should be up here for the beginning of the pretrial set. And then we've got all of this stuff that we put together for Dev.
Okay, I have a question for you too about given that we have a done on it, it's empty, does that mean that the name is all we have on it? And that all we have is that we've decided that it's a feasible motion and there's nothing, no work done?
Really, pretty much. Well, see, that's what's unclear to me. There shouldn't be, my understanding is, there shouldn't be empty files because people in California were supposed to finish these things, but they obviously did not finish them all. That's nice. Now, one of the other things, see, partly it might be if there's empty file folders in the 2B files, it's because they haven't been finished. Or what it might be is when Barbara started making up the Dennis Banks file, she started taking them out of the 2B files and putting them in the Dennis Banks files, leaving blanks here. One thing that needs to be done, it might be a good job for you, is to go through and make sure that everything that's here ought to be in here. Now, every motion that we've got for a Dennis Banks motion should have a corresponding 2B motion, although it doesn't work the other way around. And that would be a good job in terms of familiarizing yourself with the stuff. But we should check on that. Although, obviously, the Dennis Banks motions themselves will be resources. The way we decided we would look at the 2B ones is simply as a resource for all pretrial motions for all cases.
Okay, so all the motions that we have at all anywhere are either in the consolidated motion, in the to be filed, in the Dems next.
Right. Yeah, those are all pretrial motions, which is really to say all motions in state v. any of the custody defendants, because there's a whole thing you get into, you know, like other cases, which aren't really motions, but they have pleadings, and I don't want you to get confused with them. Like, we have, like, say, writ of prohibitions, the writs of prohibition, that sort of thing, but they're not motions. All of the motions are in those three places. What I did was a memo on the status of the pretrial motions. I prepared this a couple of months ago, and it's a good thing to look through. Whoops. Gives you sort of a history of how things happen. I go one by one with, I believe, only the consolidated motions. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, I say when it's filed, okay, like the motion to change pen is filed, 11-15-73 for all cases. Anything relevant that Janklow may have said or done, relevant things from the judges, any action taken on the change of venue orders, that sort of thing. Just generally, things that I could think of which would relate to the history of a particular motion. It's really pretty self-explanatory. The one about the consolidation is probably one of the funnier ones. Okay, like I say here that the bottom sign of the order establishing the master file, then David Hill filed separate motions on December 1st. Okay, Bottom was going to proceed with the David Hill motions in December until the case was removed to federal court. Then Beauchamp granted 228-74 consolidation for the four, should be four defendants, I forgot. Oh yeah, okay. The four defendants, but indicated that it was only for these four defendants, no others. And that's in the transcript. PC is Paul Clifford. Bottom held hearings in April, said he couldn't hear arguments and motions for defendants who weren't there. Janklow, on February 1875, argued with DJB, that's Dennis, we do everybody by initial, motions had been decided based on consolidation. Young said there was a stipulation in the file that pretrial motions were to be held on a consolidated basis, but then he agreed to let the transcript settle the argument. Okay. And one other thing I can remember is the stipulation. That Judge Young mentions at one point in the hearing on Dennis's case. The stipulation was between Pratt and Janklow, and it says that all exhibits for the consolidated motion set aside the grand jury indictments, which were entered into evidence in the Bad Hat Bull 5 case, will be also entered into evidence for the Carlson people, and the same with the testimony. The same with the testimony given for the motion to suppress. Now, the thing that's significant about that is that the stipulation only refers to those two specific motions. It doesn't refer in general to the consolidated motions as having been, you know, evidence having been filed to everybody. And it only says that's an agreement between the Bad Hat Bull 5 and the Carlson 4. It doesn't include everybody else. So it's really limited in its scope, and Janklow can't interpret it the way that he was trying to interpret it at one point. So that's a good thing to read. That usually is hanging up on that board over there. That's it.
Just go over some of the stuff from the Sarah Bernhardt book trial. Mostly it seems like what we compiled was things that went wrong.
There wasn't a whole lot that went wrong.
Right, that's true. I thought that we should try to be a little more constructive than just tell you things that went wrong in Bernhardt book case, but maybe that's all we say. Okay.
One of the first things that we wanted to talk about is Janklow's style. I don't, Bill, have you been in court?
Not against him, but I've watched him in court before.
Yeah. Because, well, and his style may be a little different for us than it is for most of his adversaries, but he's got a very distinct style. And one of the things that he said to people, like in Sioux Falls, was that, and this is what Father Bill Walsh told me, the Janklow said to him, was that he had essentially let the defense hang themselves. He plays a very low-key role in the courtroom, usually. That changes a little with Dennis. He gets a little more uptight with Dennis than normal. But he's very cool, just sort of lays back, and helps you hang yourself without, you know, anyone seeing him manipulated. But he does that. And he really plays up to the judge a lot. And most judges, like Foshan, think that the Attorney General is God anyway. I don't think Young is quite like that.
Young's not
the
law court. One of the other things he does is he plays up to the lawyers, the defense lawyers, and it worked real well with Ramon. He used Ramon's first name all the time. He made it obvious efforts to chat with Ramon as the jury came in so the jury could see Ramon and Janklow talking together. The way the defense tables were set up in Sioux Falls, it was Janklow also at that trial was doing it all alone, and he made sure that there was only one guy at the table. But he would sit here, and Ramon was right next to him, so they could chat during while someone else was doing the examination. Finally, what David Hill did was he put himself between Janklow and one of the lawyers, and Dennis may want to do that too.
That was two different tables at Custer.
There were two different tables in.
Yeah.
But they're quite a bit apart in Custer.
Yeah, we're talking about primarily the civil defense building where things were very tight.
That's
and the
true.
Court, the courtroom will make a difference. But he still he does that in a lot of ways, you know, calling Ramon by his first name and that sort of thing. But just, I don't know, it's very ugly. I know how Dennis feels about that. I have a feeling that Janklow probably will not do it so much in this case, because Dennis will be very antagonistic, I would guess. The other thing that he does that's pretty interesting is that on defense witnesses, he really tries to establish a connection with Indian people. He always brings out, and he'll do it continuously, brings out his work at Rosebud, the work he's done for Indian people, the fact that he knows that there are three different, you know, Sioux languages, that he knows a little bit about Indian culture, and he'll make as much of it as he can.
When we had Indian people on the witness stand, he would throw in Lakota or Dakota, where he would use words in whatever dialect they use in order to impress them.
Yeah.
And it worked pretty well on the jury. It didn't do a whole lot for the witnesses, but the jury liked
it. The jury found it pretty awful. The witnesses found it pretty awful, but the jury was really impressed by that, and he really managed to make a big play about it. That's something I think people have to be wary of, because you can call him down on that. He doesn't know all that much. It's, I think, a very superficial knowledge.
Where are the Fifth Second cases?
They're not in this office.
Probably about two
overhead.
Blocks away.
Do you want to go down there and do some research later on, or what?
Well, I just wanted to get that video of the case.
Do you have the site on it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the site on it?
Yeah.
Okay, when we get done, I can get down and get it.
Okay.
If you want. Okay.
Other things, we talked a little bit about pretrial stuff. There wasn't that much, I don't think, that came out in the pretrial that isn't really obvious science. Obviously, the defense was not tight enough in terms of the evidence we put on. I think those are all problems that we're not going to have in these hearings. Things were pretty sloppily done and ill-prepared. But one of the complaints that Karen and I both had about the pretrial that we had also about the trial is that the lawyers did not prepare the witnesses. We did all of the preparation of witnesses without any instructions or any assistance from the lawyers, which was really bad because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know what they were going to be asking. Put him always off the wall anyway. He didn't pay any attention to what we knew or didn't know and just asked questions off the top of his head, which I don't think will happen in this case. But that ill preparation really showed up to the jury.
Right.
And every juror that I ever interviewed mentioned it. Janklow was very well prepared, very tight in the prosecution, and the defense was exactly the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, the defense would... They'd even get the name. I mean, Jack Pratt had a horrible thing with names. They couldn't get the names of defense witnesses, right, as well, or defendants. And the jury, the people were all about that to me. I mean, even a year later, the foreman of the jury is still talking about the no-nos we did in court.
Yeah. In terms of the voir dire, something that was obvious to you, Bill, in reading the transcript, Jackwell almost never does any voir dire to speak of. He asks a couple of questions, usually sort of in a rehabilitating line,
mm-hmm.
maybe four or five questions, and that's it. He doesn't care. And he makes it obvious to the jury that he doesn't care. Everybody's, you know, you're perfectly all right with me. It's these people over here to my left that are worried about you.
Yeah, he managed, without trying very hard, to make us look bad in asking certain questions.
That we had no right to, if we were prying into people's private lives, and that there were people driving around seeing what kind of homes you live in.
Yeah, is that one thing? That's not right.
Yeah.
And the lawyers reacted guiltily to this. It wasn't as if we had every right to do it, and they were sheep-faced, and it affected the jury.
Yeah, I think that there are a few different things that both the judge and the jury need to be educated on. I think it's really crucial. One of them is the whole right of the defendant to investigations, both jury investigations, so that people don't get defensive about having questions asked of them, asked about them, you know, of other people, or asked of them about themselves, or they don't get worried because someone's, you know, going up to see what place they work in, or, you know, driving by their house to look at what their house looks like. You know, that all needs to be explained in terms of, you know, the obvious right of the defendant to do that, and it's not an attack on them or anything like that, because the people in Sioux Falls, some of them felt attacked by that. It didn't come out as a big issue in Sioux Falls. It evidently did in Council Bluffs come out as a really big issue.
Yeah, it came out as a real big issue in Lincoln.
Okay, it was Lincoln I was thinking of.
And the whole, everyone in the jury room was talking about it. We had to bring him in and explain that it wasn't illegal. But we had Judge Irvine, who was much better in terms of explaining things, and I think Judge Irvine would be. One of the other things about voir dire was that no one on the defense team took the necessary meetings after each recess to discuss the jurors seriously. I mean, there's a certain way that the Shulman, or whatever you want to call it, technique needs, and that is you come out, you vote on the juror, 1-5, you discuss them and then you vote again, and it has to be done real quick without any bullshit, and has to be done, you know, with a lot of discipline. And the defendants didn't take it seriously, the lawyers didn't take it seriously, and as a result, the people who were, you know, in court didn't take it very seriously.
Yeah.
We also did not have someone in the room doing body language,
or even any general, or
just watching to see reactions.
Yeah.
I know that Gail and I were both having to take, since we weren't getting daily transcripts, having to take verbatim notes, plus, you know, write down questions. The voir dire, it was very difficult to do both of those and have any kind of eye contact with the juror. But yeah, it was pretty important.
Yeah, there's really nobody. The defendant situation is tremendously different, and that'll mean a lot. But there was no one in that case, except for occasionally when people would come in, to be watching the jurors. It will also matter with having more than one family alert lawyer. We had two lawyers, one of whom was not all that alert. So, you know, I mean, you could work it so that with three different lawyers, if y'all are all in court at one time, when any one lawyer is doing the voir dire, the other two can be watching the juror. We didn't have that sort of cooperation, you know, and switching off of roles in that case. And I think that's important. I think it's also important to have other people come in during the voir dire and to be watching what goes on, whether it's, you know, we're thinking about trying to get people like David Suggs, a sociologist from Lincoln, and a couple of other people who would be considered experts to be able to come in during parts of the voir dire. That's really important because we never knew the jurors at all. I mean, after what was essentially a lengthy voir dire, 2 to 3 hours on most jurors, unless we got them off for cause, and all of the people that were on the jury, we must have had at least 2 to 3 hours on, a minimum of an hour and a half. But we didn't feel like we knew the jurors at all, and that feeling maintained throughout the trial. I had no sense at all of the jurors, of what they were thinking, of what, you know, of what they were relating to and what they weren't. Jack and Ramon both had decided that they could read Jack 3 of the jurors and Ramon 2, and they were both wrong. Completely wrong. They were really naive, and I think that was one of our big complaints about the people that we were getting on the jury. And we're thinking, I think that it was a lot easier to educate people in the voir dire process than it really is. And a lot of times, a specific complaint was that a lot of times when we would think that they should continue to push to try to get someone off the cause, they'd pass it the cause.
Neither one of them would go far enough in their questioning in terms of racism. Ramon thought it would offend the jury to talk about racism, so he never brought it up.
Or if he did it, he did it in a way that was offensive.
Yeah.
As an attacking sort of a thing, not the least bit subtle, and a way that would put people on the defensive in their responses. And I think that was a big problem.
Jack's idea of bringing out racism was saying, well, would you let your daughter marry an Indian?
No, or did you see...
Did you see Soldier Blue?
What did you think of it? Good movie? Okay.
Can I ask a question? How did they handle the voir dire? Did they just kind of shoot from the hip, or were they reading the questions that were prepared, or were
Jack
they...
had a notebook that had categories of questions.
Mm-hmm. You can see that it's already been typed up.
I was just wondering how they... excuse me.
Yeah, with certain questions, and he would try to do one from a category. And they always did stay with... Well, Jack had a system and stayed within those categories. Ramon shot from the hip.
How did that affect the jury, the juror, when evidently he's going through categories and originally probably had to refer to his notes about questions they asked?
He did it poorly, and I think they reacted badly. Mm-hmm. I think that my impression was that they reacted badly to the whole process that we were going through, but it wasn't because of the process so much as the way it was being handled.
They were,
the attitude of the attorney that was questioned, and not
Jack
necessarily
fumbled.
The style or...
Really fumbled through the whole thing, both in terms of his, he was very nervous, and I know I was watching, one of them, it was McDougal, but when I was watching, he was facing, and you could see his hands going like this, and the jury could watch it too, and he was obviously very nervous, and they could see him twitching, and that affected him, and the fact that they fumbled a lot. There were just long pauses between questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't go fast enough.
He wasn't standing while he was doing it, was he?
A lot of the time, he was.
Sometimes.
How did that affect people, whether you're standing or sitting or in just talking with the jury?
You evidently haven't seen the Custer courtroom yet, have you?
Hmm.
You can't sit.
Sorry?
You're going to have to stand.
Damn far away.
You're too far away and you can't get close to the jury.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it had a big effect. I think more what had the effect was the whole nervousness of the defense. I mean, it came off as not being tight, not being prepared, not being together. And my impression as a person is that if I'm on a stand and the attorney interviewing me is nervous, I will get exceedingly nervous. And I think that's how every one of them reacted. Why is he nervous? He must be doing something wrong. He must be doing something that is uncomfortable to people. Because he's nervous and he knows what he's doing, so there's a reaction.
And our reaction to that was, hastily, just madly writing notes. David, Gail, and I got very good at formulating questions for review.
But that also is a problem because it looks that much more ill-prepared because you have these three people sitting in the back scribbling away. And it's a whole way of working in the courtroom, which is one of the things that we were talking about that we wanted to raise. The two complaints I have, and they sort of seem contradictory, but they really aren't. One is that in a lot of instances, Karen and I had much too much responsibility in the case. A lot of things were laid on us that never should have been laid on us. On the other hand, when we felt like things we had to say were very important, it wasn't paid attention to. And that it was a serious mistake in the way that the defense was not a team at all. And that came off to the jury, and it came off really badly because, in a lot of ways, it came off because the lawyers were nervous. It came off that way because the jurors didn't know who we were.
You even had a couple times where Pratt was objecting to Ramon's comments.
Right.
Yeah, I mean,
fell over when I read those.
Things like that are really off the wall. You won't have, I mean, obviously you're not going to have problems like that. And Ramona's was just sometimes off the wall. And you're not going to have that kind of extreme of a problem. But more along the line of the jurors are not automatically going to have a relationship with any non-lawyer in the courtroom. And the lawyers are going to have to establish that. And that was a main problem. One of the very significant problem in that case was that the lawyers never established the validity of Karen and I as members of the defense team, and yet we were relied upon heavily out of court.
And in court for, like, during witness questioning, I mean, they didn't read the witness file, so we were there, and we were at the defense table, and we had to write on what questions to ask. It was obvious that we were writing away, and we were writing questions that the lawyers were asking. And, you know, the jury didn't understand that, why we were there, and then why the lawyers were... It was obvious to them we weren't law students, we were dressed like law students.
Did Judge Bottom make any comments at all?
Yeah, originally, during voir dire, we were allowed to sit in the well. After that, he said no. We decided we'd put one of us up with the defendants on the, you know, the chairs at the back of the well.
Mm-hmm.
One of us sat there. Eventually, both of us sat there.
Yeah.
After the courthouse fight, neither one of us were allowed in. Then one at a time we were allowed in the well and the civil defense building. We had free access. Could wander in and out during court.
Yeah. He never said anything in front of the jury, but the fact was that the lawyers didn't either. And the posture of the lawyers was very strange toward us because it was as though they didn't know how to deal with us in the courtroom either.
Mm-hmm.
And if we weren't a part of the defense team, and whatever... You know, whatever sense of discomfort or whatever from the judge came off from the lawyers, too.
It's obvious that Ramon didn't want us, which is not a problem y'all are going to have with the lawyers.
it's really a serious... I mean, to the extremes we had it, you won't have it. But in the more subtle nuances, it is a problem because I think that it's going to be up to the lawyers to establish the relationship of the legal workers to the defense, to establish them as an integral part of the defense, so that you don't start with these jurors saying, who the fuck are these stupid little kids running around this courtroom? You know, what are they doing there? Which is really the attitude they had toward us. And when you start with that attitude, and then these stupid little kids are writing notes and trying to tell the lawyers what to do, the jurors see it as an irritation.
And continually being attacked by the prosecutor for supposed illegal and or...
Immoral.
The lady in green and the little yellow one.
Was he going through that?
Every single prosecution witness, Jankler would say, have you ever been approached by anyone from the defense?
And posing said, to be an authoress or not.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You know, uh-huh. Who was it? Oh, it was that lady in green over there. I wore a green sweater every day because I froze in court. Or, you know, that little blonde one there. I was called Susan. I saw that in the transcript today. My name was Susan on several occasions. And he, just because of Janklow's manner, and because Janklow essentially had control of the courtroom from beginning to end, he was able to make it look as though, for some reason, we had no right to do that. You know,
how
did
he do that? Yeah, how
he
did
was
he?
Very, he just said, have you ever been...
No, I mean, how did he have control? You know, what do you attribute that to?
To weakness in the defense, ill preparation on the part of the defense, very
well,
good preparation.
But I'm more interested in...
Well, like that, what I used to do with Bill Meyer and get away with it is, now, the defense attorney knows better than that. He shouldn't ask that type of question. Well, that's not an objection. It isn't anything. It's a comment.
You know, nobody'd
say anything. Just
yeah.
Get away with it.
You know, we've got...
Time.
We had we took our pictures every day to court. And, you know, Janklow would continually infer that we had pictures he didn't have. Well, finally, one day, he walked up to the front and says, now, they've got pictures in this book. Jack Pratt, I'll give you my book if you'll give me yours. And he walked up with our book to the jury. That's something that nobody should have allowed him to do. And Jack Ramona,
but
oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Yeah,
that was the attitude. That's what I was more concerned about. Not what he said, but, you know, how he... reacted to have some sort of control over.
Well, he starts out, I mean, given the non-adversary nature of the so-called adversary system, he starts out with the control, and I think that you have to do something positive in order to seize the control.
I mean, the way we did that in the pretrial on April 18th was really fine. I mean, Doug knew exactly what he wanted done. He knew the order of the motions, and he, you know, had a little thing that would help the judge, that order with the granted, not granted, modified, which was a real plus in our favor. And it was just, I mean, we would never have thought of doing that.
The judge thanked him for it, talked about how convenient it was. And that just that kind of thing where we were better prepared, and it was obvious that we were better prepared. You start out with an advantage in this case. Janklow is Attorney General now. He doesn't spend all of his time working on Custer cases, even though he'd like to. So he's not going to be that well prepared. You start out with another advantage. We had two mezza lawyers at best. Jack is not a criminal defense lawyer at all. And you know, that was a big problem too, because they weren't quite sure of what they were doing, certainly weren't sure of what they'd gotten themselves into, and were very ill-prepared in the general sense of not having a defense for the case, you know, not having prepared a general strategy for the case.
We worked on a day-to-day basis. I mean, it was no more than that. We couldn't even get through, I mean, it was like, if we can get through a day without Ramon passing out, and the defendant's passing out, and with that, you know, something horrible happening, it's great. And never any thought of what, you know, what we did before, what was going to happen later, any kind of overall strategy. Never once even talked about a defense until it was time to do opening statements, and then they said, okay, what's our defense going to be, Gail and Karen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was really pitiful in that respect. And
you mentioned they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. What did you mean by that?
Factually, they had no idea.
Yeah, I mean, Jack, when he came to work on the cases, I think just literally did not know what he was getting himself into. And Ramon acts always shooting off the hip. I've never seen Ramon prepare for anything in 2 years that I've known him. That's just the way Ramon is. Ramon is one of those people that should never, ever be involved in a heavy, lengthy case because he doesn't work that way. And, you know, with small, short cases, he can work the way he does and get off with it. Not in the kind of case we were facing. And that was a major problem. You had two people doing the legal work who knew all the factual stuff, who'd never been through a trial before. And I knew that there was something missing. It was called strategy. But it was very hard to find it.
We kept looking. Every night we'd go out and look for strategy. Ramon would look at the Holiday Inn bar, and Jack would look at the house, and Kayla and I would stay at the office looking for strategy. But it never showed.
We searched in our files. We had looked under the table in the legal room. But it was no strategy.
She liked the phone book. Call them up.
That's it. We found the answer. He's a lawyer.
It was pitiful.
It was really sad.
And on the specific sense too, we were ill prepared. You know, you go home from a day of court. Karen and I would go home to a Xerox machine and the file cabinet and preparation, if we could, for the next day. Another big disadvantage we had then, and I'm sure you're not going to have now because Young will not let Janklow get away with it, is we never knew who the next witnesses were going to be in this case.
The only way we knew the witnesses was to go in the civil defense, and we had to go into the kitchen where they kept the coffee, and that was the way we'd know, or send someone into the men's bathroom to find out who they had that day.
We had a hard time getting in the men's bathroom.
The judge told us a no-no to go into the men's bathroom.
Yeah, and we had to skulk around in order to find out who the next witnesses were going to be.
You know, every once in a while we'd badger Jeff, and he would feel sorry for us, and he'd tell us who he'd seen.
Yeah. Or, you know, we'd try to badger Janklow, and Augusta Janklow would try to play his little games and say, well, it's going to be either so-and-so or so-and-so or so-and-so, that kind of trip. But we never knew, so that was a big problem. And you know, where were the lawyers those nights? They certainly weren't. They weren't doing anything with regard to the law, and they weren't doing anything with regard to the
no
facts.
No research was done at all during the case until Wayne Crawford came.
And then when Wayne didn't have any directions, he didn't do a hell of a lot.
Who's Wayne Crawford?
He is a law student that worked with us.
So one of the problems was that we had two people, and we had no daily transcripts, so one person had to take verbatim notes. The other one had to do whatever else was necessary in terms of listening in. And when both people have to go back at night and do the witness files, plus we'll have to deal with clients like we had last time.
But I think that there are like general things that really summed up all of the problems, and they're really combatible problems. And one was Janklow's control of the courtroom,
mm-hmm.
And that's a very combatible problem. Given Dennis and how nervous Dennis makes Janklow, that's a step forward. Given strong defense preparation, you're going to kill him, because I don't think that Janko is going to be as well prepared this time as he was last time, and especially in comparison, he won't have the same thing on us that he did the last time. I mean, he was very prepared, defense wasn't prepared at all, and he looked very good. I did a lot of juror interviews, and everybody to a T talked about that, talked about how well prepared Janko was, how, you know, he obviously had the case down, he'd done a lot of work, he always did a lot of work, and the defense, well, you know, you just couldn't figure out what the defense was going to do next, and they were just...
We had Ramon saying one thing in the opening statement, and Jack Pratt totally contradicting, and we had the written art, the defendants contradicting what we said in the opening statements.
Mm-hmm.
We had that transcripts that might have helped. We could have checked over and see what had been said.
What sort of cooperation do you expect from our witnesses this time?
Our witnesses were not a problem at all. And
okay.
we had fine witnesses. When they weren't fine witnesses, it was lack of preparation usually that was the problem, or lack of judgment in terms of calling them, or lack of judgment in terms of the questions that were asked of them, which are all problems that we encounter. You know, we did things like, we were trying to determine who the defense witnesses were going to be, and we're getting no direction because there wasn't a strategy for the case, getting no direction in terms of what we're supposed to be establishing.
You know, without any idea of the law, I mean, no research had been on the law, we didn't know what elements had to be proved or disproved.
Vaguely, we didn't know.
Riot. You know. And we brought in some dynamite witnesses who you're probably going to want to use again, like Edna Two Dogs.
Yeah, and, you know, the Zephyrs from Yankton, and some people who were really fine in terms of setting a political tone for what happened at Custer and for why Indian people went to Custer. Most of them were elderly people and they're spiritual people, and they were really, really fine. It obviously couldn't prove the whole thing. Those were the witnesses that did make a big impression on the jury, but what they saw was these two things were totally unrelated. They saw the prosecution case, which proved the crime against the defendants, and then they saw these nice old people come in and talk about Custer, and that was very fine, but it didn't relate. And that was a major problem that the jurors raised, was that a lot of the things that the defense brought in, they couldn't see how it related to the trial. We tried to bring in the Gordon, Nebraska demonstration over Raymond Yellow Thunder's murder, and it was done so poorly that, first of all, the judge really limited us on bringing anything in.
The mayor of
St. Paul and the mayor of Gordon, ex-mayor of Gordon, and the ex-state's attorney of Gordon all had offered to testify. The mayor of St. Paul about the relationship of, you know, AIM to St. Paul and the kinds of things that they'd been doing up there, just as a general sense of what can be done to prevent overreaction on either side, just, you know, told liberal mind that might have been helpful. And the people in Gordon would have come in and just talked about the whole difference between how things were handled at Gordon and the result, which was no violence, and how things were handled at Custer and the result. And the judge completely limited us on that. He wouldn't let any of those witnesses testify.
And people didn't fight. The lawyers didn't fight on any specific issue hard enough. I mean, there are things that we could have tried on another angle, and they just wouldn't try. We could have brought in the treaty, at least on some people's testimony, but they just were too, they wouldn't try it. You could have,
The way the treaty was brought in was, you know, something by Jack saying, you know, you've heard of the 1868 treaty, haven't you? Doesn't the 1868 treaty still hold, and, you know, isn't Custer part of the Black Hills? Oh, you know, this little rap that meant nothing. I mean, it wasn't related, it wasn't made to relate to what was happening, because there's no political strategy involved in the case in terms of educating the jury to Indian people, to the treaty rights.
I mean, people will get a lot of direction from Dennis on that. I mean,
when Dennis walks in with his certified copy of the 1868 treaty and says, I want to talk to you a bit. He introduced it into evidence. No, he didn't even put it into evidence, so he should still have it. He used it in his opening statement at St. Paul.
Who is it certified?
It's copies of the original 1868 treaty with all of the original signatures.
It's a copy that's gone to you.
No, it's a copy from the Library of Congress.
Oh, one thing back on Bordier that was never mentioned as a really important aspect is the whole line about following the judge's instructions.
There's a lot of things you want to mention with Bordier.
Oh, man. Well, you've been finding a lot of those, but
Really, the only reason I've used the word "are" things is to find out exactly, you know, what line Jangle takes. And
he asked us four or five questions.
Mainly what his reaction were to type of questions that were asked.
He didn't have to react.
What were you referring to?
The whole thing about, all the jurors thought that people had to prove themselves innocent.
Yeah, I mean, things like about the law, about the burden of proof, and about... The whole line of questions that you can develop about whether or not people will actually follow the judge's instructions,
or whether they'll follow
their own intentions. And that specific question, I had seen it used in St. Paul and knocked two people off a cause who had been on that stand for about 4 or 5 hours each. And just couldn't get them off, and it was the question. It was that question that cinched it.
Very seldom you see a clincher question.
Yeah, there weren't any.
They set some people up and then let them off.
Yeah. We'd try to set them up, and then things just wouldn't be strong enough, wouldn't be tight enough, just wouldn't be sharp enough to get the person off.
There was a couple times that Bottom let him off himself because he knew if they.